Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and this episode is sponsored by Utter Nonsense, the hilarious and fun-filled party game. Now, have you ever wondered what it's like to see your friend orgasm or take a poop? Reveal these mysteries and more with the Chicago-born party game Utter Nonsense, currently available at Target stores nationwide. Check it out at utternonsensegame.com. That's utternonsensegame.com. And we're also sponsored by the 7th Annual Dallas Comedy Festival, and they are officially open for submissions. If you're a stand-up, improv team, or sketch troupe, you can save $15 off your submission fee if you register before November 10th. The festival takes place March 23rd through the 26th in warm and sunny Dallas, Texas, and this year promises to be bigger and better than ever before. Visit DallasComedyFestival.com for more information. That's DallasComedyFestival.com. And to check out my award-winning improv classes and workshops here in Chicago, The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. And if you're feeling frustrated in your improv career and you want to get a bigger, better improv career, I want you to check out my brand new book, The Inner Game of Improv, 5 Steps to Getting Bigger in Your Improv Career. It's a very short read, and it's only $3.99. You can get it as an ebook on Amazon or as a PDF on my website, jimmycorain.com. Here we go, another episode of Improv Nerd, and we've, of course, I don't even have to answer your question. Yes, we have a great episode of Improv Nerd for you. Our guest today is Irene Marquette. And you can't get more accomplished than she is. She is a teacher, performer, director, writer, and she teaches at IO Chicago, The Annoyance, and the Comedy Studies program at Columbia College. She is host of the popular cult classic, The Curio Show, and she was directed by TJ and Dave at the Mission Theater for both the reviews, Trapped and Undressed, and she currently plays with Tone in Superhuman at IO Chicago. We talked to her about starting out as an actor. She worked with her parents, who ran a murder mystery dinner theater and moved around the country. How she found improv at 19 in a coffee shop in Las Vegas, and how important it is to do the kind of improv that you like to do. Before we get to the episode with Irene, I just want to let you know that I haven't slept well the last 2 nights. Because my doctor has given me this special pill with cayenne pepper that's supposed to help with my memory. I don't know if you know this or we've ever talked about this on the podcast, but I lost a lot of weight about 12, 13 years ago. I lost it too fast. I was about 268 pounds, and I got down to about 168, somewhere in there. And I did it like 6 or 8 months. And I didn't know that actually you can lose weight too fast, which is dangerous because you can do damage to your organs. Now, the only 2 side effects that I had from losing all that weight was, one, I was cold all the time, especially in winter. I couldn't get warm. But that seemed to go away. The second one, which I still have, has affected my short-term memory. I will try to go and find a word in my brain and can't find it. And so I've been working on going to different doctors to try to correct this, because I really feel like it happened when I lost all that weight. So the latest thing is I'm going to this doctor every week, and he gives me a little packet of pills that I have to take every day, and I'm hoping it will correct my memory, because it's really scary, especially as an improviser, a performer, someone who does a podcast. You really need your memory. And I hope I can get some sleep, too, because when I'm tired, my memory is even worse. So, enough about me. You're going to love this episode. You're going to love Irene Marquette. Here it is, the Irene Marquette episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
So, you were into dancing as a kid.
Yes.
Ballroom dancing and belly dancing. And you started belly dancing at 13.
Yes, I did.
Now, belly dancing is considered kind of a sexual dance.
Well, not really, but...
Okay.
How did your parents feel about that?
They felt fine about it. I think that one of the big misconceptions about belly dancing is that it is like...
Set me straight on this.
Yeah. Well, okay. I think that like there is an unfortunate association with it being like a form of stripping or something. And that is not necessarily the case. It's an ancient dance. It's a sacred dance. It's a celebration. And let me explain how I was belly dancing. My friend's aunt was a belly dance teacher, and I would go with her to this like art school on like Tuesday nights at 9 o'clock, and they would turn off all the lights and light candles, and it was me and a bunch of middle-aged women, and they would light candles and like play drums, and we would like dance around the room together. Thank you. I think it's awesome as well. And then we would gather in someone's yard for the solstice, and we would like dance under the stars and burn sage. And I found myself like at points during my teen years going to like psychic bookshops and belly dancing after hours. I don't know if you guys know that they do that sometimes. You can belly dance.
Did you ever go to a psychic? Because I love psychics.
I've never been to a psychic.
Okay.
No. But I would go to a psychic. I've had my cards read. I think it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you want to go to a psychic for?
I don't know. To just like see what they have to say. Like I'm so interested in what they would turn over. And yeah, I don't know. That's why I want to go to a psychic. I don't know what they would say. I'd be interested.
So now your parents also owned a dinner theater in Las Vegas.
Yes.
And you wrote some of the shows and even performed in that.
I did.
How did this experience make you a well-rounded performer?
Well, I think it was my first experience with improvising, even though I didn't know that that's what I was doing. But you are performing, you know, in tables, like as people are eating. And some dinner theaters actually have the actors serving food. I mean, it is like you really learn how to get attention and pull focus and keep people interested. It also requires you to have kind of a thick skin. And they put me in a position to be a professional at a, you know, pretty young age in that way. And it also like helped me find my comedic voice, even though I didn't realize at the time that that is what I was doing.
But, and you guys were doing murder mysteries, right?
Yeah, murder mysteries. Murder Cafe is what it's called. And they still do it in the Hudson Valley area of New York now. They've added another division called Theater on the Road. And it's they're like adapting classic stories, stuff in the public domain, and like going around to libraries or schools and doing performances of them.
But you wanted to get out of the family business.
Yes, I was sick of it.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
Was it hard to work with your parents? Did they have attitudes? Were they prima donnas in the murder mystery dinner theater circuit?
True divas.
Right.
Oh no, not at all. I just think like who ultimately like when you're a teenager who really wants to work for their parents, and it was weird, you know, like my dad is in costumes and all those lame jokes of like, oh, what are you paying your babysitter by the hour? You know, if the show is running long, or what do you say? What do you got, a spell checker lady? That was another one. Like, there's.
Wait, I don't get that.
Oh, like if someone corrects something that you're saying, you know, like if you would say something and like if there was a malapropism in the script and
somebody screwed up or.
Yeah, somebody would be like. Like would say something and he would turn around and be like, what do you got, a spell checker lady? Which I think in the 90s was like a pretty hip joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you probably heard that hundreds and hundreds of times.
100 times. Yeah. And I don't know. We were like such a band of gypsies, I feel like. And I got to a point where I was like, I don't even know if I want to perform. Like, I don't know if this is really what I want to be doing with my life. And I didn't want to always be doing dinner theater. I wanted other experiences. I wanted to study different things in school. So I kind of like backed off from it around my late teens.
Now, were your parents, because you were amongst adults, I would imagine. You were
yes.
The one kid. So if somebody said, you know how we are backstage and so, said something sexual or inappropriate or whatever, how did your parents handle that?
Well, I think people really looked out for me in that way because I was young and I was... I think mature for my age, and I was a good talker. I'm the oldest, and I didn't have any siblings until I was 4. So I was around adults a lot, and My parents were really good at like picking an ensemble of people. You know, there weren't creeps or perverts lurking about being weird. So, and at the same time, like, man, you know, you love those kind of jokes. Like, if I hear an, if I was a kid and I hear an adult say something kind of off color, I'd be like, yeah, yeah, all my friends are, you know, doing kid stuff, and I'm sitting in a green room with a bunch of adults. Like,
but did you ever feel like the adults were trying to censor themselves around you?
No, I never felt like that. I never felt like that, but I don't know. I mean, we would go out to bars afterwards, and that is kind of strange to think about. Like, I can remember being 14, 15, and getting done with the show, and then hanging out with a bunch of adults in a bar. You know, cracking wise, telling jokes. They thought I was quite a pip, I think.
And after high school and after doing the murder mystery dinner theater, you go to the University of Nevada.
Yeah.
And you decide to study anthropology.
Yes.
Why anthropology?
Well, my great-grandmother was very interested in, like, human sciences and culture. I went to Catholic school when I was a little kid, like for elementary school. And at the same time, she was, you know, living on the first floor of our house, and she would tell me about the Egyptians and other cultures and other religions, and it really started to open up my mind. And I was always really interested in human behavior and what people believe and why things are the way they are. Why, like, I remember sitting at a school assembly and having a group from Russia come and like do a dance performance, and part of the dance was that they were doing like a marriage rite. And I was sitting there and I said out loud, it's so weird they have marriage in all cultures all over the world. And someone was like, shut up. So it just like always really interested me. And ultimately, like, that is the stuff that I think helps you really as a performer. Like, it's, you know, we approximate human behavior. We, like, it's like what we do is empathetic, and it behooves us to understand why people do the things that they do. I didn't really make that connection at the time, but and that's something that has always interested me and continues to interest me. Culture, religion, customs, history, you know, how all of those things kind of change and develop. So.
And then when you're 19, you you go to a coffee shop.
Yes, to do some homework.
I
was, at that time, I was taking some medieval literature classes because I was like, this is my true path. I thought I'm going to be like a real serious intellectual and like have a dusty desk and get leather rot in my lungs. I was like really looking forward to it.
So you go to this coffee shop and you see performers from the Second City, Las mm-hmm. Vegas cast, doing long-form improv.
Yes.
What do you think when you see them?
It totally blew my mind, and this was a coffee shop where I would go and, like, you know, they have poetry slams and experimental music, and but I had never seen, like, performers ever in all my experience do what they were doing. They got up on stage, and, like, all of a sudden the coffee shop started filling up with people. It was packed. And it was so weird, like, what is going on? And then they all got up on stage and they said, ladies and gentlemen, we are absolutely not the Second City. Can we have a suggestion? And then they did 45 minutes of the most amazing performance I had ever seen. And I thought, like, oh, God, I'm just trying to read my Piers Plowman. Leave me alone. But and I'm like, I'll check this out for 5 minutes and see what's up. But I was so, like, mesmerized, and I kept coming back week after week, and I couldn't figure out how they had done what they were doing, and if they, like, mapped it out beforehand, and how were they making the connections that they were making. It was, as somebody who I would consider, like, was pretty well-versed in different types of performance and had been exposed to a lot of, like, other types of theater, I had never seen anything like that. And the idea that it was, like, spontaneously created was just staggering to me.
So you become a groupie. You keep going each week, right?
Yes, like, real quiet and weird, just sitting alone being like, I gotta figure this out.
What was going in your head, like, figuring it out? Like, what were some of your theories?
I thought that it was pre-planned. Like, I really was one of those people. And, you know, we like to be like, oh, can you believe so-and-so thought that we planned this out beforehand? I was one of those people. Like, it didn't make any sense to me. And I thought, well, maybe they have an outline. Because I'm familiar with, like, I didn't know it at that time, but you know, basically a beat sheet and improvising around a beat sheet. Like when we were doing dinner theater, it'd be ad-libbing. Like, oh, we know that these characters are interacting, and then this happens, and we just kind of ad-lib until, you know, the murderer is revealed. Most of what we did with my dad's company was like fully scripted, but there were definitely opportunities and times to kind of go off book and ad-lib. But this was a totally different thing. So I didn't know how they did it, and I couldn't figure it out, and it never occurred to me that it was something that I could do.
And you loved it so much, you started to take class at the Second City in Las Vegas.
Yeah, after about 6 months.
Like, why are you laughing about it after 6 months?
Because, like, it took that long. Like, and when the idea came up that, oh, you should take classes, like, I finally, after a couple months, I think I got the courage to actually talk to them, just be like, what is this? How are you doing this? And they said, oh, you should take classes. I thought, yeah, right, there's no way. And then I finally did. And it was really fun.
And then you take classes, and then you go to a Second City cast party, and you're playing this character game.
Yeah, I think it was either it was Murder. Did you ever play Murder?
No, explain it.
You have a bunch of people and hand out like little slips of paper, and one has an M on it, and that person is the murderer, and then there's an investigator who kind of is figuring everything out.
So this must have been in your wheelhouse, right? Coming from a murder mystery background,
yeah,
you're like,
Jimmy, I live for murder.
Right. Yeah.
Everyone puts their heads down, and then the investigator says, will the murderer please look up? And then that person's the murderer, and everyone puts their heads down again. And then you have to figure out who the murderer is. So then round by round, the murderer gets to pick somebody off. And it's a strategy game, and it's just like a really fun party game, and everyone gets mad, and like feelings get hurt, and it's like, why don't you trust me? It's like, because you're really the murderer. So we would play games like that, and I think there was one where we were doing like character voices, and I just let it rip.
You remember what character you had done?
Honestly,
you do, and you don't want to share it with us.
I think it was like Jesse Jackson.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This is like 2002. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was okay in 2002 to do Jesse Jackson.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you do Jesse Jackson, and in a way, you get this. You come out of your shell because at this point, you've been very shy. You're laughing. What's so funny?
No, I'm just thinking about myself doing a Jesse Jackson. Right.
But that's doing that. Where does that lead? Someone's impressed by you doing Jesse Jackson in this murder game.
Yes. And then they're like, oh, the quiet girl's got some spirit to her. You should come and audition to be an understudy for the Second City show.
When you heard that, how do you feel?
Well, I thought I didn't believe it, but like a lot of things in my life, I thought, oh, I'll just kind of check it out, see where it goes. And then they got it.
So you get it.
Yeah.
And you start understudying for?
Kay Cannon.
Mm-hmm, who, of course,
is, in my mind, the biggest star in the world.
Mm-hmm. And also in the cast is Jason Sudeikis.
Yes.
And were they dating at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that they might have been engaged.
Okay. So you are understudying Kay Cannon. How was that?
It was awesome and terrifying. I will also say that in one scene I had to kiss Jason Sudeikis and right before the show I got really nervous and I told him that I was sick and I couldn't do it. So we adjusted.
What was the adjustment?
Handshake? No, I think like he kissed me on the cheek or something. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember what the scene was. But I remember like being so terrified of it all day, like I can't do it, I can't do that. But it was great. And she, I really remember Kay running my put-in rehearsal, which was terrifying. T's and B's, chair
tops
sets.
Tops and bottoms.
Yes.
Okay.
And setting
chairs.
Yes.
For each scene.
Yeah. I'd never done anything like that before. And especially on that level. And then it all became really real. Like, oh, this is a paying Las Vegas audience. And this is a prestigious thing. And like, I'm just like trying to get a degree so I can be an English literature scholar.
You're still in college at this
yes,
point.
Yes, yeah.
And they've thrown you into the fire, then the deep end of the pool. You're learning as you go along.
I was, yeah. And she was like, she's very direct. She was a teacher and
a school teacher.
Yes, and she was an athlete, and she's just like really. I feel like this is Kay. Like, the cards are here. Like, we're doing Pictionary, and she's like, they're not here, they're not here, they're not here, they're here. Every single time, here. And, like, over and over again, and thinking about,
and just for the people on the podcast,
oh, yes,
she's doing object work. She's not, there's not the cards there. She's saying, you go to this
box
yes, that's in space,
yes,
and it's not moving.
Right, and that was so crazy to me. Like, the idea of object work, I mean, I had seen them when they were improvising in that coffee shop doing object work, which I probably called, like, miming at that time. But I remember there was a guy, Mike Lucas, who was a stand-up, and I remember he was doing a monologue, an improvised monologue about eating a Rice Krispie treat. And he was talking about, like, the perfect consistency for a Rice Krispie treat. And as he was doing it, he's, like, demonstrating with his hand, like, the perfect viscosity for this thing. And I could see it. I mean, to this day, like, that monologue is still kind of wedged in my brain.
Thank God you didn't have to do that, because Cave would have had you.
Oh, my gosh.
You know.
Yeah, I would never have done anything again.
Right.
But it was great, and she was wonderful, and, like, again, I'm the youngest person. I was the most inexperienced for this world, but just, like, my parents' group of people really kind of took me in and protected me. I found a similar thing there. There was a point, for most of my life, I was always the youngest person in the room, and then something changed a few years ago, and now I'm always, like, the oldest person in the room with improv, which is really funny, but I guess that's just how it goes. They were all, like, very kind, and they helped me, and getting notes from the stage manager afterwards was terrifying, but
what
awesome.
Was so afraid, what was so scary about it?
Just the thought that I would make a mistake that could screw everything up, you know, or that, like, they made the wrong choice with me, or that I wasn't ready, or I didn't get it, or, like, that I would fail, that I would forget all my lines, that I wouldn't know what chair was supposed to be where, that I would fall off the stage, like, all those things that you think, like, it was so real. And I had a lot of performing experience, just in, you know, not with something like this. And sitting down and getting notes from her, I remember, like, and night after night, because I think there was, like, a pretty good stretch where I went in a bunch of shows in a row, and I remember there was a line that I could never get it quite right, and she was, like, really stern with me about it, and I don't know, it's just, like, scary to get notes sometimes. You have to learn how to take a note, I think. And
what is the best way to take a note?
To be quiet and listen to it and process it and apply it in the best way possible, I think.
Being defensive is not a good way to take a note.
I would say no.
Okay. And not only was Kay a huge help with you there, but she was also a big influence on your decision to move to Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely. She was a friend, too. And, you know, she was a hard worker and continues to be to this day. And her work ethic and her tenacity really inspired me, and she was so aspirational to me, like, then and now, of course. Like, when I think about, like, an ideal career, she is one of those people that is the first in my mind. But I remember, like, sitting down for lunch or something with her and saying, like, oh, I don't know, I feel kind of down about Vegas, because Vegas kind of sucks, to be honest. Sorry, Vegas people. But when I was living there, I felt like I reached a real tipping point with it. Like, what am I going to be in Vegas? Am I going to go somewhere else? And she's like, you need to go. You need to make a plan and make a goal and do it. Go to New York, go to Chicago, go to LA, go somewhere, like, go do whatever you want to do. And I'm like, okay, but when I get there, what will I do? And she was like, whatever you want. And I thought, oh, yeah. That, like, cracked my brain open in a way, you know?
Do you think that's why she's so successful?
Yes, because I think that she is, you know, and she just moves forward. But she's got forward momentum.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, if she landed on a deserted island, she'd be a success.
Oh, yeah. Know? Yeah, there would be a condo there, like, 6 months later.
So you come to Chicago.
Yes.
And you study at IO. And
yes.
Eventually you get on a Herald team.
Yes.
And then eventually, like most of us, you get cut.
Yes.
How did you make that an opportunity, getting cut from a Herald team?
Well, I was cut from two Herald. Well, I was. I didn't make a Herald team out of my 5B classes, and I auditioned and was put on a team called The Future, and then was that team was cut, and then I was put on a team called Go-Go Manifesto. Hi, Jason. And that was it was hard to get cut from that team, and I remember I was on vacation with a friend of mine, and she was in grad school at the time, and we made this really impulsive decision to go to Amsterdam. And I got off the plane after a long flight, and my living situation for the week didn't pan out. And I checked my email, and they were like, "You're cut from the team, and we hate you." That's not what it said, but that's how it feels, you know? And I remember, like, I wasn't going to let this get me down, and it was right after that I got into directing. Yeah.
And so you get into directing.
Yes.
And then how was that? How did that help you get over being cut from a team?
Well, I think that I probably wasn't, I know for a fact that I was not the best, like, personality, I think, for a Herald team. Like, sometimes that is true. Like, you get to that thing that you want, and then you realize, like, it's not exactly the way I pictured it, or like, it's just not, it's not right for me, this, like, wonderful, prestigious thing. And I had been in several situations up to that point where I was in a show, and I remember thinking, like, oh, I wish the director had done X, Y, or Z. Or and I think for both of those teams, I had maybe 10 coaches total. Like, both teams went through a lot of, like, turnover with coaches and subs, and I remember, like, taking bits and pieces from, oh, I love what this coach did, or this director did, or I didn't like what this person did, and feeling like, oh, I can't let that make me frustrated. I should put my money where my mouth is and, like, be in charge of something and see how it goes. So I did.
And, you know, many, like, IO students or UCB students that don't get, you know, they're on a Herald team, and they feel like, you know, they got caught. They feel like they failed, right? But you realize, you know what? This form doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
What would you tell people?
That there's a lot of places to perform. There's a lot of ways to perform, and you need to find your tribe of people and your thing. And it's okay to be honest with yourself about something not working, or and like whatever way that is. If a theater tells you like you're not right for us, I mean that's such a hard thing to hear. It's always a hard thing to hear. But there's a place where it is right for you, and it's kind of just a matter of, you know, trial and error and being persistent. If it's something you want to do, there's enough places where you can do the thing that you want to do until you find your right way to do it.
I think it's really interesting because it's kind of like taking the round peg and shoving it into the square hole, but you realize it really soon, you know? And since then, I mean, you've been performing with, you know, independent improv teams and sketch reviews, you do solo work, you direct. Why is it important for you to not take that traditional path?
Well, my parents aren't traditional people, and I don't know. I think that I'm restless in a way. Like, my parents are restless, and that is something.
Is that why they move around all the time?
Yeah, and they did move around a lot.
I'll talk to them about it after the show.
Please talk to them about it. New Mexico, Connecticut, New York, Las Vegas.
Was that hard for you, them moving around
yeah.
all the time?
In
what way?
Well, I mean, it just kind of is not the coolest thing to settle and then be uprooted and you know, go someplace else. I moved halfway through fifth grade, right before middle school, and then I moved again the summer before my junior year of high school. That's a tough time to move. I think fifth grade was fine. Right before my junior year was, like, kind of dispiriting in a way, you know? Like, oh, man. Got all my friends. I'm on track. At Highland High in Albuquerque, which is where we lived before we moved to Vegas, There were 8 valedictorians in my graduating. If I had I stayed in that class, that school, that would have been my graduating class. Wouldn't have been a valedictorian. But it just kind of goes to show like what the emphasis was at that school and what my peer group was really valued, which was, you know, being smart, being interested. It was an arty place and right near college and right near UNM. And going to Las Vegas was a huge culture shock in that way. You know, then it's like schoolgirl. Did anybody get called schoolgirl? You know, it's like a derogatory, like, oh, look at you, you've got your homework. You know, schoolgirl. Anybody ever hear
did
that?
You ever, were you ever like, you had to be upset as a kid every time they said you had to move?
Yeah, I also was like a real daydreamer, and I really loved imagining like what my new life would be. I think when I first moved to New Mexico from New Haven, I took the opportunity to take on a New York accent. That did not last very long, and I don't think it endeared me to my peers very well, but, you know, it was an early move. And I remember thinking about being in Las Vegas and, you know, the lights and the glitz and the glamour, and I still, like, made it work for me. I was volunteering at film festivals when I was in high school. I was working for this place called Players Network, which was in a company that did videos that went into hotels. So, like, you know, here's something you can see off the strip. By the time I was 18, I had so much experience doing video editing, which is completely obsolete technology now. I was a grip. I'd been a production assistant. I was always, like, a young person just, you know, hanging out with older people. Those old tech guys really got a kick out of me.
You, TJ and Dave put up 2 sketch shows.
Yes, they did.
At the now defunct Mission Theater.
Well, it's still in existence.
Right.
They're just not running it.
They're not running it. It's still at the I.O.
Yes.
And you performed in both Trapped and Undressed.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like to be directed by TJ and Dave?
It was awesome. It was an incredible experience. And I just feel so lucky that I had the opportunity to experience that. They are totally different. They're totally different, and they will like whisper things to you. Like if you're, you know, working on a scene together, and it was a totally new way of developing material for me. I had worked with Mick Napier the summer before on Invisible World.
It was a sketch show at the Annoyance.
Yes, and his style was like come in with, you know, 12 ideas.
Like this typical Second City review. Come in with ideas and present them.
Yes, and this is like a much more gentle, like, we're going to improvise, and then here's like all the instruments from backstage, and just spend 20 minutes like creating rhythms together. It was awesome, and it was 3 days a week for, I think, 4 hours a rehearsal, and it just like such a special time to get to work with all of, like, everyone in the cast, and then see the different way that TJ and Dave work. Watching TJ direct the opening of that show, which is like one of my favorite things. And I had seen him, did you ever see Misled? The
No.
show with Peter Gross and Pat O'Brien, Michael
No.
O'Brien. That show was incredible. And the choreography of that show really inspired me as a director and all the connections that they made. And I remember watching TJ think through what our opening was going to be and kind of like using us as pieces, you know, like, oh, James, will you walk behind this door? And Peter, can you close the door when he opens the window? You know, that kind of stuff. And I remember sitting in the house watching him figure that out and think, oh my God, that's TJ. He directed Misled, and now he's directing me. And oh my gosh, I'm watching him do it. I'm in rehearsal right now. Ah, I just got so excited. I feel like I was sitting in the house with like a big smile on my face the whole time. And then the way that Dave, like, coaches you as an actor was really awesome. Like I feel like I am so much better than I was before I got involved, and I really learned a lot. And they are open-minded and flexible and like with ideas, you know, like they're very firm in like knowing what they want and getting that out of you. But, you know, like there were a lot of conversations that we would have, and it was just so cool to have the chance to, you know, create something with them.
How was it when they told you the news that, you know what, we can't do this anymore?
It was sad. It was really sad. And I think it wasn't necessarily a surprise because we had experienced, you know, there it wasn't like people were beating down the door to come see these shows. But there was like, in that last month, there was a real uptick in sales. And we were like, we're going to pull through. We're going to make it. And then they gave us the news, and they gave us, I think they gave us like a month's notice, or maybe they gave us a traditional 2 weeks notice. I don't remember now. But August 1st would be the last show. And it's really, yeah, it was really sad. Like, but at the same time, while I am so sad that they don't have a space where they can put up what they want, I think it's really amazing that they have carved their own path for themselves, and they've done something non-traditionally and really succeeded, and they can enjoy their success. And like, I personally have the memory and like the enjoyment and the betterment of having worked with them, you know? So while it's a loss, ultimately, like, it's a huge loss, like, there's so much positive stuff that came out of it, and they really did set a tone, which is the name of their improv ensemble that I perform in. I think that they set a real tone for that theater, and they, you know, put things in there that they care about, and things that are totally different from what is in I.O., and it was like a great jump start to whatever that space will end up being, you know, a few years from now. So, and it's not like they're going anywhere. They're still doing their show on Wednesdays, and they've got Tone that the cast of Undressed was folded into when the show ended. So we're still performing, and we had a rehearsal with them a few weeks ago, which was also really awesome. Like, oh my gosh, how are we not paying for this? You know, like, how am I not writing them a check for the opportunity to have them watch me improvise and give feedback? It's just so cool.
So we're going to improvise now.
Oh, yeah.
Are you excited about
yeah.
it? Okay.
That's my excited face.
Okay. People listening in the podcast, that was Irene's excited face.
Yeah.
She gets kind of blushed in the face and real smiley. And her eyes kind of twinkle. So we're going to take a suggestion.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And then we're going to do a scene.
All right.
What do you like to take for a suggestion?
Let me think. A suggestion of the last thing you wished for.
The last thing you wished for.
World peace.
Now, you hear world peace.
Yes.
Such a big concept.
It is a big
it?
Concept, yes.
How do you use it as a suggestion?
Well, immediately I think of that is such like a pageant response. So if I that would make me like maybe want to play a pageant girl, or maybe like the mother. I immediately think of pageants when I hear world peace, because it's such like a, you know, that stock cliched answer. So I might go that way.
Okay. I hear world peace and I shut down. I don't have any idea whatsoever. It's such a big concept.
I mean, you got to break it down into bite-sized pieces.
Okay. Do you want to help me here?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So world peace.
World peace. Well, so, I give you my answer.
No, you got, but that's not going to work for me.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
So what is, maybe I don't know, maybe you want to go for the opposite of it.
World peace.
Yeah, if that's the answer to something, maybe you want
okay,
to
okay, world what, peace, like, how about, I would think of it like a guy who's afraid of any sort of confrontation.
That's, yeah, great.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And
think,
is he like the head of the UN?
I didn't go that far.
Okay.
That's all I could do.
That's good.
It's like a guy who doesn't want any confrontation.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
He's afraid of confrontation.
Yes.
Okay. So now I hear that, but like, now how do I put that into a character?
Well, I mean, you just described your character. So okay. Maybe, yeah, I would, if you're somebody who doesn't want confrontation, then I would put myself in the middle of a situation that requires confrontation.
Okay. All right.
Right.
Let's go. Yep.
Okay.
You can't take you cannot take any of the pastries off this table.
What?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, you don't understand. I am very hungry. I haven't eaten anything for the last 10 days.
No, I understand that, but if you see what the sign says?
Yeah, I don't care.
It says for staff. You're
I just
staff.
Want you to know that I don't care what the sign says.
Oh, okay.
And those look great to me.
Great. So if you could just put that back, I would really appreciate it. I'm going to go get it myself.
I'm sorry.
What?
I really would prefer if you didn't. I'm very hungry.
Did you already eat it? Did you touch it?
I touched it.
Okay. Okay. I'm licking it. To take another one is to take three is you're putting me in a very awkward position here.
What position is that?
That it's called uncomfortable.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize there was a pastry master.
And dropping dropping them on, you can don't step on them. Really, really. And
I am very hungry. Do you understand? I don't care who the staff is that this is for.
Yes,
do you know what I have done to get here?
I probably slept with someone. Great. They're all on the floor now. Great. 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 Great.
All right, pastry king, pastry master.
My name is Larry.
The
Please
president
do not throw
of
them at me. Please do not throw them at me. I'm wearing a sport coat, okay?
Larry, tell me, how does a man get a job this prestigious? I'm dying to know. You know? Because when my life doesn't work out, I think this is what I'm gonna shoot for.
I see what you're trying to do.
What is that?
Well, you're trying to, like, put me down, but I'm just going to ignore that.
Am I?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Larry.
Okay, please.
Larry, I'm so sorry. Hmm. Oh, I'm so sorry. Hmm. That must have been very hurtful for you.
It was. Please. Enough. No, those coffee cakes, please. Not with the cherry coffee cake. Please, please, please. Don't. Putting your mouth on that is just, you're not even eating it, and you're just wasting a lot of food. Okay.
Larry?
Yes.
I need to know where I can get a baby wipe and a tub of Vaseline.
Okay. You're going to need to put in a requisition.
I'm not doing that.
Okay, great. I've got a key. I've got a key to the cabinet, and I can take care of it. Okay? So if you would be kind enough to just pick that stuff up, I will get you some baby wipes and some Vaseline.
Vaseline.
Yes.
For my teeth so I can smile?
Yes.
You understand?
Yes, I do.
Because I'm so hungry and this didn't satisfy me.
Well, none of it went in your mouth. You just...
I can't swallow it, Larry. If I swallow it, I could be disqualified.
Right.
This will bloat me right up.
Right. A lot of the girls just eat it and then they go in the bathroom and they throw it up.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. That ruins the enamel on your teeth.
Right. Okay, I'll get this. Okay? If you could just clean that up, that would be great. Because if Chet comes in, I could get in a lot of trouble.
Oh, don't worry. I'll handle Chet.
Okay. Okay.
Larry, how long have you been working here?
I've been since the pageant started. That would be in 1995.
Great. Just want to let you know I've got about 40 minutes until it's my time for evening gown. So you and I are going to be hanging out.
Great.
Got any kids, Larry?
I've got two, yes.
Oh, okay. Are they proud of you?
You're very, very, very proud of me. You said baby wipes, right? Baby.
Yes, for my hands.
Great. Okay. Okay, here is the baby wipes.
Can you do it? Wipe me down, Larry.
I could do it, sure. There we go. Okay. Enough with the baked goods, okay? All right. Here's some baby wipes. There you go. There we go. There.
Get it off my chin. Mm-hmm. It's been so long since anyone's been nice to me.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, okay. Vaseline. Okay.
Do you have any ice?
I can get you some ice.
I'm very hungry. I chew on it.
Sure, a lot of the girls chew on it. There you go. There's your Vaseline. I'm gonna have to lock that all back up.
Do you have daughters, Larry?
Yeah. they're in the audience. They come to all the pageants.
Are you going to have them participate?
No.
Why?
Because I see what pageants, you know, they do to some of the women.
What's that?
I don't want to go into it. Can I have the Vaseline back? I gotta make sure I gotta make sure that it goes back there, because if Chet comes in here,
don't worry, I'll handle Chet.
I know you say that, but you know I'm not as good looking as you, and Chet yells at me.
I bet a lot of people yell at you.
Yeah, my wife does.
What's her story? Where is she?
She's working. She's working.
Ah, yeah. Two working parents in the home.
Yes.
That must be nice.
Well, it is. We go on nice vacations. We've got an above ground pool. that's not cheap to clean, you know.
An above ground pool.
You know, just squeezing that the those cupcakes like that. No one's going to want to eat them. If you'd like one, just you can certainly help yourself.
Really? Because I thought this was only for staff.
Okay. That was you know what? That my mistake. So help yourself, but don't squeeze them like that, because no one's going to want to eat them after you've touched them.
I need a baby wipe.
I'm going to have to open the cabinet again.
You can turn your back to me.
Don't tell anyone I'm giving you this special treatment. We're supposed to treat all the pageant contestants the same.
Do you see any other contestants around here?
Not right now, but they'll be in here. And I know a lot of you pageant contestants, they you talk amongst each other.
Sometimes.
There you go. There's a baby wipe. So I've got to just write this down that you've used 4 baby wipes and an ounce of...
Can you clean me, please? Larry, I said please to you.
Yes, I know. There you go.
Do you know how long it's been?
That you've said please?
You're being so nice to me.
Well, there you go. There you go.
Would you vote for me?
For what? In
anything. Would you vote for me?
We're not allowed to say who we would vote for. So
Larry? Would you vote for me for president?
President.
If I was running for president.
Of the United States of America.
Yeah, is there another type of president?
Yes, there's a lot of presidents. President of the PTA, president of...
What's a PTA?
It's a Parents Teacher Association.
Would you vote for me for that?
Probably not. But like secretary or treasurer? Do you have kids? No, you don't have kids. Well, that's why I wouldn't vote for you, because you don't have kids.
Oh, is that the rule?
It's called Parents Teachers Association.
What a narrow organization.
If your kids are in school, then you can qualify. There's other presidents. Okay, you know, now, see, no one's going to eat that cream cheese now that your fist is in it. If you'd like some, just you can use this knife here. Throwing that on the floor, if you could clean that up, I'd...
Larry, I'm not going back out there. I was disqualified. Does that freak you out?
Yes. No one's ever been disqualified.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm the first.
Yes, you are the first. Rubbing more food on your stomach is not going to do it.
It's better than eating it. Don't you want to know how I became disqualified?
I was going to ask that, but I was hoping you would tell me that. I understand that you're upset, but rubbing cream cheese on your thighs and the rest of your body.
Can you clean me?
I can only clean contestants. I think you should just take your tote bag there and your backpack and just go out the stage door.
In my dress? Oh. I slashed a girl's tires.
What did I think? Yeah. I thought, in what way? Just like straight up?
Yeah, how'd we do? Yes. How'd you think we did? How'd you think we did?
I was conscious about making patterns.
Okay.
And I think that
can
that
you
was
explain?
Good.
Can you explain that?
I actually thought there was going to be a light shift right at the beginning. I don't know why I thought that. And
a light shift?
Yeah.
With the lights?
Yes, just because okay. Like we were talking about it and then we started.
Okay.
And when you were moving over this way, I thought you were, I don't know why, I just was like, oh shit, we're in the scene now.
Right.
You know that happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh yes, here we are. This is a table of food. So that was like a really nice grounding place and I could just continue to go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And make a full.
So tell us about the patterns that were in your head that you're trying to, how you work.
Well, I was thinking about the pastries that like once you told me not to touch it, that I think I'm just going to touch this as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, oh yes, I'm a pageant girl, so I am just going to have a really violent relationship with this food. And then anytime I get the mess on my hands, I want to feel like a baby and be like, wipe me. So yeah, I think that was it. Like just coming back to those things
mm-hmm.
helped.
And we played it very slow, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Was there anything you would have done differently?
I don't know. Yeah. Gosh, that's a hard question.
Mm-hmm.
What would I have done differently? Maybe come right out of the gate faster. But at the same time, I don't know. I one of the things I really love about playing with tone is that we do play kind of slower, and there is that sense of discovery, and like you are where you are, and the scene unfolds. What I love about playing with Superhuman is that we are always doing new forms, and everybody on that team plays so differently. And sometimes somebody is like coming out the gate so strong, and it's really fun to like match that energy. I love both things. I am loving playing with tone right now. So I guess that slower pace is kind of on my mind.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I wish it was funnier, and I feel like I could have been funnier. But I'm just trying to not try to be funny.
I really try not to think about that so much, I have to say.
How do you do that?
Think about it?
Well, and not be conscious of the laughs and not worry about being funny. Because, you know, as teachers,
right.
We teach it all the time, but when we get on stage, it's sometimes a different story.
Yeah, I guess my mind is occupied with who are we to each other? How are we moving this forward? Like, what is the deal with us? I think that's like a real annoyance thing, like my character's deal, like what is my deal, what's like our deal together, and then just playing it. I want to always get to where I like feel like we're on the same page, and it's just going. So those are kind of like the thoughts that occupy the part of my mind that would be judging myself. And I always think like, and I think about this as a teacher too, and you know, you notice it when in doubt, make a choice. When you don't know what's going on, declare something. When you find yourself drifting away, reinvest. Have a way to connect your partner.
What was the deal? If we took an annoyance term, what was the deal between us two?
The deal between us, I guess that we were both outsiders of this other thing that was going on. And I'm sorry that my take on a pageant girl is like kind of some like sad girl who like can't eat the food and is like gonna take all her frustration out on the food in front of her. But that is kind of where I went with it. And that you're like babysitting me in a way, and that I'm provoking you.
And did we keep it going forward?
Yeah, I think so. What do you think?
Could we have had it gone, taken it even further?
Yeah, always, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can always dig in more.
I think, for me, now that I think about it, I think had I made the choice that we knew each other, maybe this was your eighth pageant, or I knew your mother, or you were my child, or something like that, might have given us some more mileage, too. Mm. So I wish I would have had more of a shared history with you.
I think that is always a strong choice. I also like it, it's. I've never like analyzed a scene that I've been in immediately after doing it.
Is that this is the first time?
Yeah.
Okay. It's
yeah,
an exclusive.
It's interesting. Yes, yeah. This is an exclusive.
An Irene Montagne
exclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. Like to really think about those choices, because so many of them you're making. You know, you're making them all in the moment and. You're making them without reflecting on them afterwards. So to kind of think back through the beats of it and what was I thinking, why was I doing that? I also try to like disassociate myself from the expectations of like, oh, this needs to be so funny, or this could have been so much better. It's like, that is what it is, you know? It happened. It's set.
Right, I'm not there yet. Because I'm always like, oh, it could have been funnier. Oh, it should have been this, or it should have been that, you know?
Yeah. Do it and forget it.
All right. That's good advice.
I guess.
10 years, I think I will have it down. All right. So we're going to take some questions and answers from the audience. We've got one right here.
Can you talk about your process with Curio Show?
Talk about your process with the Curio Show.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you for asking. The Curio Show is something that I host once a month at I.O., and I pick a theme, and I do research on the theme. So I also have a research background. I've worked as a researcher in some other capacities. And my interests are like varied, to put it mildly. So I will pick something that really interests me. Like this coming month, for the end of October, it's spiritualism. Like I love thinking about those Victorian spiritualists and Ouija boards and people like in Paris going down to the catacombs with candles looking at like all of those bones, mediums, seances. I love thinking about that stuff. So when I thinking about that show that's coming up, I assemble the people that I would love to see kind of have a take on it. There's a guy, Lee, who's a magician. Think like, oh man, I would love to see what Lee would do with spiritualism. I have a friend who's an artist. She does. She's worked a lot with motion capture. She was working on like Paranorman and box trolls, and like she's just such an amazing person. Her name is Cammy Upton, and she's not necessarily a performer, but I think like, oh, I would love to see what Cammy has to offer. And she actually this morning texted a picture of herself in this like druid robe that she's bringing like 8 people, and they're all going to be in these like weird robes, and they're going to have a seance with puppets that she's making. So like, hell yes. And then I think like music. Oh, what? And then I think about like the kind of tone that I want to set for the show, and like what kind of vibe I want to present, how I want the audience to feel. Like I know that I want it to be kind of creepy and kind of dark and like a little bit mysterious and macabre. Like those are all things that I love, and it's right before Halloween, so it's really a fun opportunity to kind of indulge that stuff. So thinking about like who I would love to see perform and what kind of mood I want to set, because that's a big part of that show for me, is using the theme that I'm exploring to pull something out to have the experience for the audience always completely unique. I always want it to be a totally unique experience when people are coming to it. I mess with the format too, so it's always different month to month, and then I think about that like that theme, like spiritualism or cults, or I did one on Bluebeard. I do skew dark. Like, what? How do I want people to think about the show when it's all said and done? And I don't necessarily, I'll have a general idea of what people are bringing to the show, but I think it's important to give them the freedom to surprise themselves and to make discoveries. So really from them, I ask for generally what are you doing and how long is it going? And then when I know, like, oh, maybe someone's taking on voodoo and maybe, like, I've got this seance and this music piece, like, then I kind of channel my research around that so that the stuff that I talk about in between pieces or any piece that I might do myself supports what they are doing. To me, it's also really important to, you know, protect and present them in the best way possible so that the show feels really cohesive when it's all said and done.
Great. Another question? Yeah.
Okay.
Hey.
On his spot directing.
Yeah.
What are the types of, it's really a two-part question. What are the type of shows you like to direct?
Uh-huh.
And once your cast and script are all together, how do you approach it?
So I got to just reiterate for the podcast. What are the kind of shows do you like to direct? That's the first question.
It really depends on the subject. I love directing plays. I have been, I love to take a story, like the Lizzie Borden story, and find a comedic slant to it. And again, show something that I would love to see. The Jim Jones show that I did, The Raven and the Messenger, that Charlie McCracken wrote, that was like a pure brainchild. I want a gospel choir that's like a Greek chorus. And Charlie's like, yes, and we should have a devil that's the narrator. And I'm like, yes, I want to feel, I want to put up something that I would want to feel when I'm in the audience. So I really try, and to answer your second question, to make all of the processes that I have with the cast to be totally different. It really is like, how do I make the best show that I can make with the people that are in the show? How can I use the cast to the best of their ability and like to bring as much of myself to the table? So every single show has purposefully been approached in totally different ways. And I've really experimented with numbers of people in the cast. Like the smallest play I did was 3 people, and The Raven and the Messenger was like 13 people. So how can I manage that many people and show something that is like, has got a lot of different feelings and, losing the word, but how can I use those people to like present the show I want to present with no budget and like everyone's schedule being so crazy? Like that is really fun for me. It's all problem solving stuff. That's I think ultimately one of the things I really love about directing, like finding creative solutions to the problems that you have.
We got to wrap this up, but I want to get a couple quick questions in.
Yes.
While working at IO, you were in charge of the intern program.
Yes.
What makes a good intern?
A good intern? the ability to work for free. I guess to be like enthusiastic and to know that, like, especially at IO, and the model has changed significantly since I left. I left about a year ago. And I was the assistant manager of IO, so I was in charge of interns, box office, bookkeeping, office management, all that stuff. And the stuff that I really valued in interns was a great attitude, ability to show up on time, somebody who would not, be weird and hunt people down and like act like a crazy super fan. Somebody who would also be discreet. Like if somebody cool shows up to the theater unexpectedly, like don't like take like sneaky selfies with them and post them on Twitter. Like to just I don't know. I always felt like discretion, hard work, and good attitude, and like. In any of those intern jobs, you are gonna get shit, and like it's gonna suck sometimes. And the ability to kind of let that roll off your back and know that you are a real vital part of the success of the theater and the work that you do is important. And we could not do what we do without your help. I always try to show appreciation for everybody as early and often, and for people to meet me halfway. Don't call in sick and then post pictures of yourself passed out in a Las Vegas nightclub. Because, like
Patrick
I said...
Patrick Kane was an intern at IO. Patrick Kane from the Hawks was an intern at...
I guess so. No, that wasn't him, but that really did happen.
Was it's that like, the worst intern? What's the worst intern story? No names.
Yeah, I think that was the funniest intern story because I was like... And the thing was that I got them, I'll give anybody the benefit of the doubt, and I get this email from this guy, and he's like, oh, I'm so sick, I can't come in, and it was like the last day, and we had this huge event, and we were already understaffed, and I'm like, what can I do to help you? We really need you. Can you get somebody here? Like, I'll accommodate you. He's like, no, I can't, my doctor said. So I'm just like looking at his Facebook page and I see that he is in Las Vegas and at like 3:30 in the morning he posts a picture of himself like passed out in a nightclub and I thought, I got you, don't cross me.
Did you confront him?
I did.
And what did you say to him?
I think the email I wrote was, hey, are you in Vegas? ? That's all it said.
And what did he say back?
It's just like some defensive, like that's how the email read. I don't exactly remember. That was ridiculous.
If I did that, I just would never have come back.
Yeah, I think...
I just would not have shown up. That was it.
That would be it.
Because the shame is so huge.
Yeah, like don't post pictures. If you're lying, don't post pictures that contradicts the lie. Like everybody tries to get out of work and everybody does that stuff, but I know I've got my spies everywhere. That's something my dad would tell me. I've got my spies everywhere. So that is passing that on to all of you. I think that was one of the worst. I'm trying to think, like, you know, sometimes people are showing up stoned or like a little bit drunk. And
do you send them home?
You know what? I would not be working on shift when that would happen. And
someone would say, hey, so-and-so, how would they know they were, how would you get
well,
you get know, back to you that they were stoned?
We know. We always know. And also, like, you can kind of tell, mm-hmm. You know, there had to be a policy put in place about it, and we would have to say to orientation, don't show up drunk or stoned to your shift, because we can tell, and you're doing a bad job. Not that it's like... You know, you're taking out the trash and stuff, but still, like, it's a respect thing.
We've got to wrap this up. This has just been great. And we end each podcast the same way. We ask our guests to say one piece of advice that they would give to an improviser starting out today.
I would encourage you to listen and that includes listening to yourself. And only one piece of advice. I would say to really trust yourself and to find your tribe of people know that because one person says no doesn't mean the world is saying no to you. There's a lot of opportunities out there, and there's a lot of chances that you have to make your voice heard and to do your thing. You also have to find out what your thing is, and that takes a lot of trial and error. And so I would encourage you to have that trial and error and, like, suck sometimes and just be okay with the fact that, like, sometimes you suck. And, I mean... I suck plenty. Like, there have been times I get off stage and I'm like, that's okay. Like, it's, you know, that's normal. You got to stretch out your rubber band so you can, like, come back to a place that is right for you.
You even feel today you'll come off stage sometimes and feel like you suck?
Yeah. Don't you feel like there's an ebb and a flow to it? Like,
yes.
Sometimes you have a streak and you've got, like, a couple months and you're like, I am a badass. And then, like, it all, like, it feels like the rug gets pulled out from under you and, like, you get off. When I was actually rehearsing Undressed, when we were working on Undressed, the way that we were rehearsing that show and the way that we were improvising, which is totally different, it's like very functional improv. We're doing this to create scenes and to have stuff that is like viable to perform over and over again. That's a very different style of improv than like, I'm in an improv show with my friends and we're tagging out and we're editing and like bringing back characters. I would, during that whole process, I felt like I was just taken dump after dump on stage, and it was horrible. And it took me a while to realize what it was that was off, and when I realized it, I thought, oh, this is a phase. And then when I come through this, I'm going to be stronger, and I feel like I am. I feel like my, like, you know, they only made me better, but sometimes, yeah, like in the moment, I didn't feel it.
And when you say, you know, I felt it was just off.
Yeah.
That was part of the low of the ebbs and flows.
Exactly.
And you just accepted it, and you just showed up and got over it.
You have to work through it, you know? It's not like I'm going to tell my team, hey, I'm going through, like, a crappy improv patch. I'll see you in 6 weeks. Like, that's terrible. That's bad team mating. Like, you have to push through it. I guess that is the advice. If it's something that you care about, know that it's not always going to be awesome every second of the way, and that you have to... you have to like wake yourself up and push through it and like, you know, slap that cold water on your face in whatever form that is. And, you know, keep getting out there, keep pushing it, being like, oh, I can't, everyone's playing too fast. I'm just going to stand on the sidelines and watch and wait for an opportunity to have a really soulful two-person scene. Like, come on, Irene, that's terrible. That's not...
And I bet you saw, like, working at the I.O. for all these years, that people that we put up on a pedestal having bad nights.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And what did you learn from that?
That everybody has bad nights, and that it's part of what makes this so special, that it's like, you know, it is our own Zen garden, like, and there is not a guarantee of 100% hit rate. Because if that was the case, then it wouldn't be as valuable. So seeing your heroes get up and have an off night, or, you know, make a weird move, or like make a choice where you're like, wait, what? That like kind of derails things. Like, that's actually a really special, awesome, valuable thing, because if you are improvising, you are continually putting yourself out there to, you know, possibly stink. And I think that that's really good. The people that you love, that you, like, you love watching, you know, love them when they fail too, because that's, you know, we're humans. We're just human on stage.
Thank you so much, Irene Marquette, for being human
you
with
know
us.
You know, I ended that like that.
Yes.
Thank you.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the Can, and I want to thank our guest, Irene Marquette, and thank you for setting me straight on belly dancing. I'd also like to thank our home base, the people who treat us like such rock stars, that's Stage 773 here in Chicago. Also, my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. And if you want information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my improv blog, each week I will send you out an original new blog that will make you not only a better improviser, a better person, well, the better person thing is up to you, go to my website and sign up for my newsletter at jimmycorain.com. As you know, we're taking over social media, and we're doing it one piece of social media at a time. Go to Improv Nerd, our Facebook page, and like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Then follow us on Twitter at Improv_Nerd, and then go to our YouTube channel, Improv Nerd Podcast, and check out all the great clips we have there. We're also lucky enough to be part of FeralAudio.com. Feral Audio has some of the most hilarious and innovative podcasts out there. So check out FeralAudio.com. I'd like to thank both our sponsors today, Utter Nonsense and the 7th Annual Dallas Comedy Festival. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Sonfeld, I'd love having you